before I read the story, I'm reading a definition of something. I tweeted about this evening, and I said, it's not for the faint-hearted. Earth Elegies is a wonderful and really, really powerful collection of essays and poetry and prose fiction. It's really not for the faint-hearted. It's for people who can really look sort of fearlessly at these issues. So if I hadn't actually written the story myself, I'm not sure that I could read it or that I would finish it. So the challenge for me is, can I finish a story? So I'm going to begin with this definition. Negleria fowleri, colloquially known as the, quote, brain-eating amoeba, is a species of the genus Negleria, belonging to the phylum Percolozoa, which is technically not classified as a true amoeba, but a shape-shifting amoebophallogate excavata. In itself, that's a prose poem, isn't it? It's not a true amoeba, but when you read the words brain-eating amoeba, I think that's about all you really want to know about that. My story is written in a style, the perspective is sort of hovering outside the characters. Sometimes it gets into the character's consciousness, but most of the time it's ironic and it's at a little distance. And it has several different perspectives. So it has different sections. The first one is almost like prose poetry with your paragraphs that are single lines. And then it gets into more of an analysis, and then it gets into the people. And so it's deliberately written in a number of perspectives and voices. A theory pre-post-mortem. So we get the sense that there's going to be a post-mortem examination, and this is a theory that's coming pre-post-mortem. Negleria fowleri has traveled through their nasal passageways and into their brains, burrowed deep into the marrow of their bones, riding the crests of tiny waves, warm coursing arterial blood, fresh water heated by the sun, a swirl with muck and teeming with microbes emboldened in recent years by rising temperatures, fewer prolonged periods of sub-zero weather. Ravenous Negleria fowleri, devourer of brains. An adventure, they thought, swimming in the sun-warm mountain lake in the Catskills, invited to spend the weekend at the country home of old friends of Margaretsville, whom they hadn't seen in several years. If the genre is romance, then it is their genuine love for each other in the warm water shallows of late middle age that should be emphasized. If the genre is didactic nonfiction, it's the folly of the behavior in a rapidly changing climate that should be emphasized. If the genre is tragedy with a satiric edge, or satire with a tragic edge, it's the ironic ignorance of intelligent, intellectual, highly educated individuals, PhD, MFA between them, both educators, that should be emphasized. If the genre is allegory, it is their representative nature that should be emphasized, for M and G are more than simply individuals for whom personal catastrophe is imminent. Indeed, it isn't their individual selves that concern us, since we scarcely get to know M and G before their story is abruptly and rudely ended. Knowing to avoid landfills, notorious Superfund sites in which poisoned soil might be habitable again only after 300 million years, yet swimming in the lake at Margaretville without a qualm, why not? G swam longer in the lake than M, consequently G has become more infected than M. This is the theory. Probably M isn't affected at all, or if she is, it's not with brain-eating Negleria fowleri, but with another microbe, which accounts for her raging fever. But that's another theory unproven. Parenthesis, until there is an autopsy or autopsies, nothing can be proven definitively. Of nearly 7,000 languages in the world, approximately one half have fewer than 3,000 speakers, which classify them as in danger. If a majority of speakers of a language are elderly, the danger of extinction is compounded. If a language is written, it will endure to a degree. If a language is primarily spoken, it can only endure as long as there are living persons who speak it. Ji is the founder and director of the Berkline Center for the Study of Endangered North American Languages. He is the custodian, caretaker, curator of endangered North American languages. He has also been a tireless fundraiser, a writer of grants. Indeed, Ji has been called by admirers, quote, the Tolstoy of grant writers. His proposals on masterpieces of erudition and persuasion, bolstered by meticulously footnoted statistics. Yet in recent years, Ji's requests for grants from federal agencies have been frequently denied. The budget for the Brookline Center was halved in 2018 and has been halved again for 2020. Soon the center will exist primarily as a letterhead and address. Now that funds are evaporating, the building is being taken over by the more robust, younger staffed Brookline Community Center for Diversity Initiative. The languages for which Ji has been a dedicated custodian are all Aboriginal, quote, indigenous. M, who speaks no more than one language with any facility, is in awe of her husband, who could speak such languages as Comanche, Hopi, Blackfoot, Arapaho. Ji can read even more languages, including the New York State Mandan and a severely endangered Cherokee of Oklahoma. There are languages spoken by as few as 250 people, as few as 20, even 8 at last count. But a factor in assessing languages is whether the primary speakers are elderly. If there is a majority of young speakers, as with Hawaiian Sign Language, or any language that has been adopted into a public school curriculum, the language will have a chance of survival. Many speakers of endangered languages are not themselves literate in those languages and have little interest in preserving them, especially if they are elderly and if they're ill, or what is called socially marginalized. Small diminishing populations on reservations in Wyoming, Utah, Oklahoma, and North Dakota, where other problems like alcoholism, sexual abuse, and poverty are more immediate urgent. Preserving a unique and irreplaceable language is often a matter for outsiders to fuss over, not native speakers. These outsiders are likely to be white scholars with degrees in linguistics and anthropology. Ji has advanced degrees in linguistics, anthropology, and cognitive psychology. He has lobbied in Washington, D.C. on behalf of endangered languages and had been confounded by shoulder shrugs from native speakers themselves. Who cares? Other remarks are untranslatable, except as epithets. Who gives a damn? Profanities in other languages strike the ear as quaint, but sometimes a remnant of their original force remains, like a trace radioactive element in mineral. Ji doesn't let such apathy dissuade him. He can understand that Native Americans distrust white academics anathemizing their cultures, appropriating their problems as their own, assuming a position of authority and patronage. It's analogous to pressing charges against his abuser, even when the victim denies that there has been a crime. Sometimes you have to protect victims for their own good. M fell in love with G because he so loved these rare languages. Though he was 9 years older than she was and often distracted and disheveled, not a man to whom many women her age would give a second glance, yet M had never met a man like G who spoke with such passion of his work that tears shone in his eyes. Because the languages are beautiful and will pass away into oblivion without the effort of people like me. Because beauty must be preserved. Because someone has to care. Because time is running out. Their hosts in Margaretville, older than M by a decade or more, longtime friends of G's, explained apologetically that they rarely swam in the lake any longer. Too much seaweed close to shore. Too many gnats. Though certainly the lake was still beautiful. Also apologizing, they rarely hiked in the woods any longer, too many ticks, Lyme disease. Many friends had been infected, but if you were careful, as surely they would be, There was no grave danger. Also, we're not so young any longer, can't keep up with you. M&G, I'm made to feel subtly flattered, though younger than their hosts, they're hardly young. They have planned their futures carefully. They have savings, investments, medical plans, insurance. They will have paid off their mortgage within a few years. Their children are grown and gone and independent, financially and emotionally. Thank God. M jokes that empty nest syndrome gave her no more trouble than, quote, hot flashes, which is to say, nil. Each has projects, plans for books, a memoir for M, a study of the Comanche language, now spoken by fewer than 30 persons, for G. When G retires, they'll spend a year in Tuscany. Planning the future is second nature to them, a habit cultivated as gifted, ambitious school children of educated parents. M will remember with a shiver of love G emerging from the lake, water streaming down his bare chest arms, legs flattening, dark hairs against his skin like an animal's pelt. M will remember with a shiver of love how standing in the lake with water lapping to their waist, they kissed. Not usual for them in a quasi-public place, yet for some reason, who knows why, G had been in an affectionate and playful mood. Such moments of happiness cherished because inexplicable. The skin above G's eyes was unusually pale, and his eyes unusually naked without glasses. You know, I love you, my dear wife. I hope you know that. It was rare for G to utter such words, for though G was fluent in a half dozen endangered languages, he was shy in the language of intimacy. But now he spoke gravely as if somehow gazing back upon the moment. Em laughed in delight of her husband, his fatty, muscled body, folds of flesh at his waist, gut heavy, though still with hard, muscular legs and ankles. Faint with love for her husband. Oh, she adored him, who was so kind to her, overlooked her failings as other men had not done, and still believed evidence to the contrary that she was beautiful and desirable. Smiling to think with a dark wit for which in her small circle of friends she was famous. What more hope for, who can hope for a more abounding love than a folly of Jew? Though not liking it now when they swam together in the lake at Margaretville, G frequently pulled ahead oblivious of her, as sometimes he did when they were hiking together, even walking together unless M managed for them to hold hands. As if something in the future tugged at G, he was helpless to resist. Oblivious not of her, she thought, but of the presence of another. A kind of trance overcame the man, as if drawn by the gravitational pull of private thoughts. A future? But what future? Did it include M? In the languid, sun-warm Catskill Lake, in which splotches of light winked and shone like teeming life. Thank you.